And you were living in Hong Kong at that time?
Yeah, I was living in Hong Kong.
Right. Just getting on with life, and then this...
Yeah, my brother was a medical student, and he'd been sent to Africa. He'd gone to Africa to do his elective.
Yeah.
And we just got a phone call in the middle of the night. Yeah.
Oh, man.
So.
And to be so far from home as well. Yeah. And you say in your bio that, you know, you decided that, you know, that kind of life is for living, to paraphrase you probably, you know, pretty poorly. But did it feel, you know, looking back, did it seem like an epiphany through the...
At that point, yeah, it really, because I'd already started performing, and it gave me, I suppose, in a way, quite a careless live in the moment sort of... outlook to life. So I really focused on music and found that actually at that point that was really the only thing that made me happy.
Right.
I had a university place which I deferred twice because when I finished school I was working as a singer, making a really good living as a singer.
Thanks very much.
And when I finally came back to the UK and started my university course, I think I lasted a term.
Right. What was the course in?
In theatre studies.
Okay, yep.
So, you know, I thought at that age, I was like, I'm going to be famous and take over the world, and that's sort of the only thing that I had in my mind, really, at the time.
Yeah, very driven.
Yes, very driven.
So you were living in Hong Kong, you came to university in London.
Yes.
And lasted a term.
Yes.
Did you have that moment where you thought, oh Christ, what have I done? Or you just kind of cracked on?
I kind of had that feeling all the time, to be honest. I would say it's quite a dark period in my life for the sort of first couple of years that I was here, because I dropped out of university, I didn't have any money, I was really kind of living hand to mouth and didn't really know what I was doing, and to be honest I was probably quite depressed as well, still really hadn't kind of processed what had happened to my brother. So it was a bit of a mad existence for a while.
Edgy.
Yes, it was very edgy. I lived in some very interesting places in London.
But all the time the music's there, and you're making a living as a musician?
I was barely... I mean, this is what I found, is that in Hong Kong, it was at that time it was very easy to make a living as a musician.
Right.
And in London, I found at that point I could not make a living as a musician.
Yeah.
So I was working in an internet cafe for a while.
Right.
On minimum wage, and living in London on minimum wage is
it's
just a nightmare, an absolute nightmare.
Yeah.
And then, because the other thing I'm sort of kind of bizarrely good at is computers and technology and programming and that sort of thing. So I then managed to get a job as a web designer. So that's
fantastic.
So I started, my life kind of started turning around really when I found myself in an ordinary job.
It
was nice to get up, go to work every day, and actually get paid enough to eat. It's nice.
It's a lovely thing. Yeah. In terms of music, you were writing your own music from that stage?
I was in a band at the time. I was in a rock band. And yeah, we did quite well for a while. And then I kind of felt like I wanted to do something different. So we were very... heavy rock band, which was lots of fun, but I kind of felt like I never had the opportunity to do anything a bit more gentle ever. And it got to the point where I was, because we used to have this regular gig on Saturdays where we would start at 11 o'clock and finish at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I would wake up the next day and I couldn't speak all day. And I actually thought, okay, I've got to stop doing this because it's going to damage my voice.
The
band was incredibly loud.
So what were you called?
We were called Strip.
Strip.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. We were a rock band, you know.
Kind of exciting.
We were really into, I mean, we were quite different to the other rock bands at the time because we were really into sort of Led Zeppelin and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So we were kind of like almost blues influenced rock, but very, very loud.
Yeah. And you were the only vocalist?
I was the only vocalist, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Picking some rock butt.
Yes. So, actually, the guitarist in the band was the guy that I've been playing with on and off for years, and we were in our first band together in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So anyway, I kind of thought, okay, I've had enough of this.
Right? Yeah.
So yeah, in a way, it kind of worked out. Well, I don't say it worked out well, but I quit the band, and then it was only shortly after I quit the band that my mum called me and said, you've got to come to Hong Kong right now.
Yeah.
And it was because my dad was in hospital. So, as it turned out, I would have had to quit the band anyway because my dad was sick and I had to go back to Hong Kong.
Right. How old would you have been around this
time? I was 23.
Yeah.
So it kind of felt like I'd just sort of sorted my life out, got myself a job in a band and all the rest of it, and then this happened.
Wow.
So, yeah. It was like, it really, really felt like one thing after the other.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's it, because it would only have been 5 years since, you know, your brother had died, and you know, that's not a great long time, is it? It goes fast.
Well, this is the thing, is that I... You know, and I only find now in my mid-30s that I'm kind of okay with things, because I finally went to a counsellor who said, you know, we, because, you know, they always think, say, oh, there's a grieving process, and then, you know, this happens, and then it's over.
Yeah.
And this counsellor said, well, what we think now is that grief never leaves you.
Right. It's with you forever. It becomes part of your makeup.
And you just, as time goes by, you learn to live with it, and you learn, you know. So I suddenly felt better about, I was like, why am I still so sad about these things, you know?
Yeah, so, but it's okay.
So I went back to Hong Kong, and I started recording my first album while my dad was sick in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And then he died just before, I actually did live shows, and that was like the backbone of this album. So I did 3 shows at a place called the Fringe Club in Hong Kong, where I used to gig all the time.
Yeah.
And they were going to record it, and then that was going to be my album. And I think it was the day before my first show, I got really bad laryngitis. It was just horrendous. I think it was probably the stress of everything. So I was going to see my dad in the hospital every day as well, and trying to do this recording.
Yeah.
So I had to do these shows anyway because people had paid for tickets.
Mm.
So instead of it being a truly live recording, I had to do my vocals afterwards when I got better.
Yeah.
My dad couldn't come to the shows because he was too ill. And the day after the last show, my dad died.
Goodness me. Wow.
So I don't know if he kind of like managed to sort of hold on for me to do the shows. And then...
Wow. Yeah. And then, was there a period again where, you know, life turns on its head again, or were you able to...
This time round it was different. This time I was just absolutely flattened. You know, I went from when I was 17 wanting to do everything, I actually didn't want to do anything. So I kind of, I suppose, went into a really, really long depression, which wasn't helped by, I was put on this horrendous medication by my doctor, which is actually banned now, so...
Yeah. It's nice to know.
Yeah. So, you know, it wasn't the best.
Oh, man. And so, didn't help at all?
No, it did not help. I think it kind of prolonged my problem, and, you know, and I was sitting at home and not... I found that working is one of the best things to help you not be depressed. So I was sitting at home and not working and taking these horrible pills and it seemed to...
A cycle.
Yeah. It was awful. But then... During that time, because I got some money, my inheritance, I used it to buy loads of recording gear, because I'd always been really into sort of the technology side of making albums. I thought, okay, I'm going to teach myself how to record and engineer and mix and stuff. Yeah. So that's what I did in my hermit time, where I didn't go outside and didn't do gigs, and I sat at home and recorded, and I made my EP. So.
Right.
Recorded it all myself,
and
some really, and then sort of things kind of slowly started turning around, because some really good things came out of that.
Yeah.
I got noticed by, at the time, it was a guy who managed Joe Jackson, and, yep. and they asked me to do the tour with Joe Jackson.
Fabulous.
So I opened for Joe Jackson on the European leg of his tour.
Wow. How was that?
Yeah, that was pretty amazing, because I played Shepherd's Bush Empire.
Oh my God.
And I played Paradiso in Amsterdam, and I played all these really big venues. Yeah. I mean, particularly in Germany, Joe Jackson seems like a huge fan base in Germany.
Right.
So, I mean, it's still sort of like, kind of, I would say, small to mid-level size venues, but yeah. for me it was bigger audiences than I'd ever sung to.
Yeah.
So it was about 2,000.
And knowledgeable audiences as
yes.
well, isn't it? You know, that's
yeah.
what draws the crowd. Yeah.
yeah, and it was a very different audience to the type I'm used to.
Strip.
Yeah, yeah. I'm used to kind of rowdy crowds that you have yeah. to sort of win over
yeah.
and beer everywhere and that sort of thing. And especially in Germany, because I've been to so many gigs here and people never go and see the support act. People
no.
turn up late. No one ever bothers with the support
yeah.
act. In Germany, everyone was there on time. The doors opened and I sort of walk on stage and you could hear a pin drop. It's like 2,000 completely silent people looking at me.
Wow.
And it was just me and a guitarist.
Yeah. Oh,
so I was like,
you can't even
tap the microphone. Hello.
It sounds so, almost like an anxiety dream.
Yes. It was almost like an anxiety dream. The walk out, I was like, God. So,
but it was weird. Received,
yeah, it was weird because they were totally silent
yeah.
for the song,
yeah.
and then applause. Oh, yay! And then silence.
Wow.
You're the weirdest crowd I've ever played to.
Respectful to the extreme. Mm. Yeah. So the European tour with Joe Jackson
yes.
was a blast.
And
a big
blast.
And in terms of, by the sounds of it was a step up for you in terms of the audiences you were playing.
Yes.
And did it really kick you along in terms of...
Oh, this is where you get to the peaks and troughs in my career.
Right.
Not in the way that I had hoped it would.
Right.
I got off the tour, and it was a very strange experience for me, because also as a support artist, you know, with no label or anything, you have to pay for everything yourself. The main artist does not pay to take the support artist on tour.
Yeah, right.
So I thought that it would be a good opportunity, but going on tour for a month around Europe is quite expensive. So we did it by train, actually.
Yeah.
I looked at all these different options and, you know, hiring a van and all the rest of it. And in
yep.
the end, we found that the cheapest option for me and my guitarist was to get Eurorail
right.
passes.
Yeah.
And we did it all by train.
Oh,
and I thought, well, this is brilliant, because actually this is kind of an experience that most people have when they're 18 or 19. They
yep.
take their year off and they go interrailing and have loads of fun.
Yep.
So I felt a bit like a teenager, really, yep. sort of travelling around. It was brilliant. It was a great, great way to see Europe.
It's quite a romantic form of
yeah.
travel as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it was lovely. I mean, it was an amazing month, but it was very expensive. So I got off the tour and got back home, you know, and again got back to the reality of really having no work,
yeah.
and I was in debt from this tour.
Yeah.
So I had to go and temp, which, you know, it's like, okay, fine, people go and temp. And it was just so gutting to be sitting in an office temping
yeah.
when the month before I'd been singing at Shepherd's Bush Empire.
I'm like, felt like, oh, you were living a parallel life.
Oh,
yeah.
What is going on?
Yeah.
What do I have to do? And then I started writing new songs, kind of to reflect what was going on at the time,
yeah.
my frustration, and that kind of, those songs, a lot of those songs are on this record.
Right, Anywhere But Here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sounds like an incredibly negative title, but actually when you listen to the song Anywhere But Here, it's actually a love song.
Right,
so,
okay.
So honestly, yes. So I was recording all this stuff myself, and I thought, okay, what am I going to do? Because at that point I was kind of thoroughly hacked off with the music industry and kind of just been let down by managers and all sorts of things so many times. I thought, okay, I'm just going to forget about the industry
yeah.
and just seek out musicians and
right.
people that I want to work with
yeah.
and I'm just going to try and be creative
yeah.
and forget about trying to get signed or trying to be successful. Because I think if you focus on that, then you stop enjoying being a musician.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I remember when I was a teenager, I loved being a musician, and now I actually hate it. So I sent a message on MySpace, the days of MySpace, to a guy called Jeff Trott, who was Sheryl Crow's longtime co-writer and guitarist and co-wrote most of her big hits.
Yep.
And I've been a huge Sheryl Crow fan for years. So I just sent him a message. I was like, oh, you know, I'd love to work with you. And, you know, said, please listen to my music. And he replied.
Yeah.
And he said, I love your music. And he gave me his phone number in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And I was like, and he said, please call me up and we can have a talk about this. Yeah. This is all so surreal. So, you know, because I'm quite a shy person, really, and I thought, I've got to call up this total stranger in Los Angeles and talk to him on the phone. So I called him, and, you know, he was very friendly, typical LA. In fact, the first thing he said was, hey, Susie, I'm just making a sandwich. I was like, okay. And he put me in touch with... So at the time, obviously, I wouldn't have had the budget to go to America or any of that. So he put me in touch with a guy called Jeremy Stacey, who's Sheryl Crow's drummer. And he's English, and he lived in London, and he has a studio. So he said, oh, you know, get in touch with Jeremy, maybe you can talk to him about your next record and all the rest of that. So I emailed Jeremy, and he said, oh, yeah, you know, I love your stuff, come to the studio, let's have a talk. So I went to his studio. His studio's amazing.
Was it?
Huge, absolutely huge, lovely, lovely vintage gear everywhere. And he said, oh, basically the Sheryl Crow gig was paid for this. He'd been touring with her for years. And at that point I thought, you know, the stuff that I'd been recording was just sort of, was just demos, and I thought, I need to go into a studio and I need to work with a producer and get somebody to help me record this stuff properly. So I played him my stuff, and he said, oh, you know, I said, I really like the way these things sound. You know, they've got a certain kind of vibe to them.
Yeah.
And he said, I think it would be a shame to re-record them or start them all over again.
Right.
He said, you know, he said, but I would love to play drums on your album. So he said, if you bring your the wonders of modern technology. So I took all my Pro Tools sessions on my hard drive to his studio, plugged it all in, and he recorded all the drums onto my album in a day.
Well, that's amazing.
In a day, yeah. He was quite sweaty at the end.
The juice.
So I did that, and then I thought, okay, well, I need... Because I'd done most of the guitars and keyboards and vocals all myself. So I thought, okay, I need bass on this album.
Yeah.
And for a long time... my favourite bass player has been a guy called Mike Visaglia, who's Suzanne Vega's bass player.
Yeah.
And the first time I went to see Suzanne Vega, I was like, oh, gosh, obviously I love Suzanne Vega, but he's just an amazing bass player, and he's her musical director as well. And my old manager had given me his email address. So I can't remember why I was in touch with him in the first place, but I was talking to him on Gmail chat, and he said, oh, well, if you ever need a bass player, just let me know. And I was like, are you serious? And he's like, yeah, I'd love to. And also, I think it was partly because Jeremy Stacey, who's kind of quite a famous drummer, who put drums on it, he's like, I would love to put bass on your albums. And then so I was like, okay then. So I sent all the files to him in New York, and he recorded bass on it in his studio in New York, and sent it all back to me.
Wow. So layers, so building.
Yeah. So then, well, the consequence then of having the rhythm section done after a lot of the stuff that I'd done initially meant that a lot of it was kind of out of time. So then I had to re-record guitars, and I got a guitarist who was a better guitarist than me to put a lot of the guitars on the album. And then sort of the final stages for me were, even though I love the science of mixing and engineering and stuff, I kind of feel like there comes a point where you need somebody else's ears and expertise to do the thing for you. So I thought, I want to get this, get the best mix I can possible of this. And a guy called Ryan Freeland has been doing really well and just won his fourth Grammy or something this year for Bonnie Raitt's album. So he's an amazing mix engineer. So I sent him an email and sort of told him the whole story and said, I would love to work with you, and, you know, do you have, like, an independent artist rate? Because obviously I could never afford to.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, yeah, you know, I would love to, you know... I mean, the consequence of me paying, really not paying him very much money, was he kind of squeezed my songs in between sort of his big sessions.
Yeah.
So I think that whole process maybe took about 6 months, and he'd sort of send me one or two tracks back, and, you know, they come back through and, sounds amazing. Sort of the comparison between the stuff that I'd recorded, which sounded a bit like it was at the bottom of a swimming pool, to the stuff he sent back to me. Like, okay, you're a mix engineer. It's just amazing. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So yeah, so he mixed it. And then, so I feel like I'm just doing a list of, like, name drops here, but it's just, I'm just amazed that I got to work with these people.
Yeah.
And then I got a guy called John Astley to master it, and he'd mastered my EP. He does all Tori Amos's stuff.
Right.
And having him master stuff is always a lovely experience, because you go to his studio. He lives in one of those old Regency townhouses right on the Thames.
Oh,
that he bought from Pete Townsend.
Like you do.
Yeah.
My mate Pete.
Yeah. Pete was his brother-in-law. So he did... John Astley is famous for doing... He did all the Who remasters.
Oh, okay, yep.
And he does all Tori Amos' stuff, so he mastered it. And that is, there is the story of my album.
It's wonderful. I mean, and you know, to come kind of from, you know, the very homegrown, you know, to go through all those wonderful experience, professional hands, and then come out with a product that you must be supremely proud of.
I am.
Yeah.
I would recommend that any artist, especially singer-songwriters, if you are just a singer, I say just a singer like it's a bad thing, it's not a bad thing, but you need some other strings to your bow, definitely.
Yeah.
And especially if you learn to record and produce your own material, and it's so easy to get the software and do it at home, then it frees you.
Given that you can mix your own stuff, and you have got a good ear clearly for that kind of technical side of things, do you think it helps when it comes to working with other professionals?
Absolutely.
So you've got a strong sense of what you want to achieve.
Absolutely. What I wanted to change was just being the girl singer in the studio.
Yeah.
And trust me, they really make you feel like that.
Do they?
Yeah. So it, you know, it's nice to, and not just, you know, I think quite often musicians and technicians, engineers are a bit funny about singers in general, because they quite often you're not really viewed as a musician.
Mm.
So yeah, it's good to be able to go into the studio and say, look, I want this and I want this. And I think that me having such a clear idea enabled Jeremy to do all his drums in a day, you know. So because he actually said to me when I said, well, you know, I feel like I should get someone to record this and produce it, and he said no, I think you should produce it, because you clearly know what you want. The songs I'm writing now for my next album, I want my next album to be a bit more upbeat. I mean, this, I'm really proud of this album, but it's kind of quite reflective, and, you know, I feel like it's a grower.
Yeah.
I think it would take a few listens. A lot of the songs aren't that immediate, I don't think.
Right.
So my next record, I really want it to be an immediate rock pop kind of classic singer-songwriter, the type of record that you put it on and it just makes you feel happy.
Mm. Yeah.
Like Tapestry by Carole King, or like one of Sheryl Crow's albums.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I'm at the moment.
But you have to go through the dark stuff to come out to the light, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah.